Thank you, Billy. You're my name's Steve Mitchell. I'm an alcoholic. I guess you can hear me, right? I'll tell you, you guys have scrambled my nerves with this technology. I'm always a little rattled about talks anyway, but this, I always figure anything with technology is my fault. You know, and they say you can't miss or whatever. I've proven that wrong so many times. Kind of like directions, you know, they say you can't miss it. I've actually went by a place and then turned around and stopped to pee and went by the other way and missed it both times. So I'm glad to find out that it wasn't my fault anyway. It's good to be here. I appreciate the invitation, Billy. And I remember you fondly. And your wife, I see her in the background. She uplifts us all. It's good to see her. So what I'm going to do tonight, whatever it is I do, you can rest assured you ain't going to be any smarter when I'm done. What I will do, though, is I'm going to tighten my own hold on what it is I have. One of the things we all learn in the spiritual life in Alcoholics Anonymous is that whatever you send out comes back. What did the wise man say? Trash out, trash back. Love out, love back. And so, you know, our principles work both ways. It's a funny thing, but, you know, I can't try to help somebody without being helped myself, whether they're helped or not. And the same law works the other way. It says the wrongdoings of others have the power, fancied or real, have the power to kill. So, you know, the spiritual life is, it's as absolute as gravity. It's just slower. And those of us who have caught on are very fortunate because the overwhelming majority of alcoholics live their life out in some kind of, what's the old saying about alcoholism? An illness of quiet desperation. Very true. So most alcoholics never get within a screaming distance of Alcoholics Anonymous. So. I've got a sobriety date. I've got a home group and a sobriety date. I'm a member of the principals group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Raleigh. We're one group, three legacy group. We meet two times a week. We have a closed literature meeting on Tuesday nights, and we have an open speaker meeting on Thursday nights. I try to stay mindful of the fact that AA meetings are just one thing we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, but meetings are integral to what we do. They're very, very important. It's hard enough to pony up to these principles and practice them as a way of life without meetings. So meetings are life-sustaining. I heard a guy say the other day, in fact, a guy I sponsored said it on one of these meetings. He said, we've got three legacies, recovery, unity, and service. But if it was up to him, if they put him in charge of AA for a day, he'd put in two more. He'd put in sponsorship and home group. So you could say sponsorship is our DNA and home group is our address, would be another way of saying that without being hokey. And my sobriety date is May 26, 1975. I'm happy about that. I'm thrilled about that. I'm surprised about that. The way I would describe that is long days and fast years. As I look back now, you know, I can't help but do that memory lane around the birthday of AA. And it's an amazing thing to do that and to think about the people who have participated in our lives. Thinking about that the other day, you know how when you're new and you get a sponsor and you think, man, where did this guy learn this stuff? This is unbelievable. This guy said, if you don't drink today, you'll never drink. I thought, what does that mean? And then he says, today is the tomorrow you worried about yesterday. These principles are more powerful than alcoholism. You can't practice these principles to the best of your ability and drink alcohol too. I said, I wonder if that's true, and all of this stuff. And then, you know, this is the greatest man, and just he knows things that nobody else knows. And then a year or two down the road, you know, your ego has come back a little bit, and you begin to wonder, I'm not so sure about all this stuff. This guy's all that big a deal. I heard him use God's name in vain the other day. I saw him looking at girls' butts. I heard him yell at his wife. I mean, maybe... you know, maybe he's just one of the guys. And then a little bit after that, down the road, as things settle down, you know, you get that idea. He was a great man after all. He gave me everything he had. Didn't have to do that. So, you know, that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We try to keep that egocentricity at bay, try to keep it ahead. My sponsor, who died a few years ago, used to talk about the drink that was in front of him at all times. And the actions he took in Alcoholics Anonymous were to push it out, to keep pushing it out. Just keep it out there somewhere else. And I certainly don't live in fear of the first drink. I don't think I've come close to drinking since I was sober about a year and a half. But I've come close to losing my mind a couple times. And to think that any alcoholic, to think that they couldn't get drunk is the wrong thing, because any alcoholic can get drunk. Now, I'm not going to just walk off and get drunk tonight. I believe very much what our literature says. I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Our literature uses the word recovered repeatedly. So, but I could become unrecovered. I could pull out here. I don't intend to do that, but it could happen. And that's why the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous are so important. And our founders gifted us with a program of action. So we have many traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous besides the 12 traditions. But one of the great traditions we have is we share our experience. Another great tradition we have is that Alcoholics Anonymous is a written program. It's passed on through an oral tradition, but it's a written program. Our founders wrote it down. If anybody's read that book, I'm reading it right now, that book that's just out called Writing the Big Book. It's a 700-page book or whatever it is. They repeatedly, in the first couple 300 pages, that's where I'm at now, and I think I'm up around 250 or 260, they repeatedly pound that one of the reasons Bill wanted to write the big book, independent of trying to get some money, one of the reasons he wanted to write the big book is they were afraid that somebody else was going to start writing and that the message would become garbled. That they wanted to get our message out. It's our message. You know, that's what we're supposed to be doing in the fifth tradition. We're supposed to carry our message. And the message we're supposed to carry is the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, simply stated, is a way to not drink alcohol for one day at a time. It does a lot of other stuff. It can do all kinds of things. Can reverse a killer illness, and it can do almost anything. We all know one thing it can't do is it can't stop life from coming at us. So meetings are extremely important, and I appreciate the invitation. I don't take it lightly. I've never gotten used to the idea that somebody would think I could do something. You know, you always have that idea just before time. You know, am I up to this? And when somebody says, are you ready? I always say the same thing. I say, I don't know about all that, but I'm in too deep now to get out. I mean, there ain't much you can do about it now. Ready or not, here you are. It's here. So anyway, I'm going to roll on with this, Billy. And like I said, I appreciate the invitation in case I don't get back to you after the meeting. I'm going to try to share my experience, strength, and hope. I don't think anybody in the world listens to more stories than alcoholics. We listen to a lot of stories. I used to be sponsored by a guy for many years. He's at the big meeting now, a guy named Keith Lewis. And we were at his house one time, and we were getting ready to head off on a book study. Somebody had got a free place for us to hang out down at the beach, and so there was a bunch of us going down there to do a book study. And the thing I remember about that study is Keith was going to use the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions book, and we were going to deal with the steps. So his wife was there, and this woman was there with his wife, and she asked, her name was Julie. She said, what is it they do, Julie? And she said, well, the best I can tell is they get together and they just wear stuff out. They go over and over and over. And that's absolutely true. That's what we do. Not because we want to, it's not a snake bite kit to keep from drinking. It's, you know, if you look at the way the steps are laid out, the steps presuppose we're not drinking when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. So, you know, we tell our stories to stay current with what we are. I mean, that's one reason that we need to know our history. Our personal history is one reason we need to know Alcoholics Anonymous history. History makes today relevant. The thing you learn, everybody always learns in school, is that you study history so you don't have to repeat it. But history makes today relevant. There's no gift of sobriety without the pains of drunkenness. So, in 45 years, in a couple weeks of sobriety, I've listened to a lot of stories. And I've listened to some of the same people. There's people right here in Raleigh that I have heard, without any exaggeration, I don't know, 25 times, I would still drive across Raleigh in a rainstorm to hear them tonight. You know, I never get tired of it. It's like magic. It's like you can breathe now. It's just like there's power here. It's like you, and that idea that somebody's, well, you know, sometimes when people go on the podium, they say they're not going to talk about drinking a lot tonight because everybody knows how to drink. Well, there's two things involved with that. One is that's an incorrect statement because that's how we're guided to tell our stories. what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. The other part of that is when somebody says they ain't going to drink much here tonight, they usually get sober about 5 minutes to nine. So hopefully I won't do that, but I'm definitely going to I'm gonna drink whiskey, get sick, and throw up, and all of that. I'm all for drinking. I'm not. It says in our book we're not witch burners. I'm all for drinking. One reason I'm for drinking, that's where we get our members. I'm just against drinking for me. So anyway, and the other thing with that about sharing our experience, strength, and hope. If you ever wonder, if somebody just had, you know, just an overdose of wonderment and they were new to Alcoholics Anonymous, and we were trying to figure out what it is that our founders gifted us with. What is it that they gave us that kicked things off to begin with, other than a strong sense of desperation that we're running away from what we had? What is it a newcomer needs to know when they come to Alcoholics Anonymous? They need to know what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. That's what I needed to know when I came to AA. Now, the truth of the matter is most of us don't believe that when we hear it to start with, but we must believe enough of it to come back. So as I look back on that, my early sobriety, you know, I got sober on May 26th, and so it was a summer, and I got sober in a little town of Fremont, Nebraska, 25,000 people outside Omaha. And as I look back at that time now, you know, there were a lot of things going on, a lot of moving parts, but I was greatly helped by speaker meetings, greatly helped. We went to meetings every day. At that time, there were meetings in Fremont every night but Tuesday night. Tuesday night, we used the car out of town somewhere. There was a couple carloads went somewhere. And the other thing I was greatly helped by, that's why I always like, it's a written program, is after I got out of my fog a little bit, I didn't work much the first year. I literally read the book Alcoholics Anonymous once a week. And I can't tell you how valuable that was to me, that I found myself in the literature, that that's where I began to identify and I began to get some kind of hope. And then listening to meetings, that these people were just like me and they had found a way out. And I was 25, almost 26 years old when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I beat the rush of kids. They came right after me. There was a couple people in the Omaha metropolitan area that were sober, younger than me, but not very many. There was one girl in Fremont that was sober, younger than me. And I would see these people on Sunday night in Fremont. We had a big speaker meeting. And they would fill it up with food so we'd eat afterwards. We'd have a speaker meeting on Sunday night, and all these farmers would come from these little towns to the speaker meeting. And somebody would say to me, they'd pull up in a new car. You could tell they were eating good. They were a little over their fighting weight. They were dressed good. Sometimes they had nice rings on. And somebody would say to me, man, I am glad you got in here at your age so you didn't have to suffer like we did. And I think, I wonder what is it you did? You know, you look like you're pretty healthy. Now, I just got done being homeless for 2 years. I was going to the bathroom. Blood was coming out. I was vomiting. Blood was coming out. My feet were all swollen up. I'm turning colors off and on. I made $82 one year. I mean, I'm just wondering what is it you did? I mean, it's not like I'm on a roll. I got a guy sponsoring. I see Pam on this thing and Alan. I think Hayward just spoke down in Wilson recently at their home group, this guy sponsor, but he always likes to say, I wasn't on a roll when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You talk about understatement. I mean, you know, not being on a roll. Now that's an understatement. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I came running away from what I had. There was no way for me to know that I was just right for AA. You know, AA is, you know, I think sometimes we say that it works best as a court of last resort. One could almost say AA only works as a last resort. I can't imagine an alcoholic coming to Alcoholics Anonymous that had any other way out. I mean, it doesn't look like a good deal. After you get under the tent and down the road, it starts to look like a good deal. But the first time somebody recommended to me I go to AA, my reaction was, my God, has it come to that? You know, it just, that doesn't sound right. You know, I just, this is just something wrong with this. But anyway, so I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous and my life has never been the same. And that certainly doesn't mean I've been on a trajectory to stardom all the way through. I want to be careful. I try to remember that, particularly in closed meetings in my group when we talk about the steps. Or, you know, after you've been sober for a while and you've had some order come into your life, it can sound too orderly, you know, and it was not that way, and it's not always that way today. Now, it became a lot more orderly, and the steps began to order my life and give some semblance of hope to it and all the things which come with that. But I was a long way from that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I grew up in that little town of Fremont, Nebraska. I came into the world with stuff wrong with me. I guess we come that way. I mean, I don't know how that works. I don't know what Hermann Freud would say about all. I know it's Sigmund. I know that. Hope nobody texts me and tells me that. I actually had this is a quick war story, but I actually had a head doctor, great guy. I used to work in this large metropolitan hospital. Big Catholic hospital. And this head doctor, good guy named John Gustafson, came by my office one day and said, "Steve, there's something I've been meaning to tell you." He said, "I just never get a chance because there's always people around you." He said, "It was Sigmund Freud." I said, "John, I'm up on that. I just call him Herman to be a butt. You know, I'm just trying to, you know, mess with you." I don't know what they would say about this, but I came into the world troubled. And I think that I'm in pretty good company with that, because there's people on this meeting. I can see three people right now I'm looking at that I've heard tell their stories from the podium. And every one of them, and almost every alcoholic I've ever heard tell their story, talks about being in trouble before they started drinking, being in a lot of trouble. So, you know, alcoholism looks like an illness you can treat on a couch. Now, it's not, but it looks like you can, because it looks like you straighten that stuff out. Those serious problems with self-esteem and all of that. But if you could straighten out all of our mental and emotional problems, I guess you'd have a well-adjusted drunk when you were done. But you get drunk one time and that's over with, you know. So I kind of look on us as the elite of the mentally ill. And the reason I think we're the elite of the mentally ill is we know that there's stuff wrong with us, but we're in the game. We're constantly having conversations about our problems. We're constantly having conversations with our sponsors and trusted people and people we sponsor. I've been through that. That's not so bad. You know, yeah, I've had that kind of stuff. You know, we're in the game. We're in the game of life. We understand that our life depends on not only keeping that drink out in front of us, but on practicing these principles. So I came into the world troubled. I came into the world afraid. I've always been afraid. It's always been a problem. I'm in better shape today than I've ever been with that. But it's just scared. And if somebody were to ask me what I was afraid of, I don't even know if I was always knew that I was afraid. I wouldn't have been able to put it into words. And I came into the world also angry. Now, one thing I absolutely disagree with. You know how people say little kids don't hate normally? They have to be taught to hate. I don't agree with that. I don't ever remember getting any training in how to hate. It just came with me. It was just natural. I'm afraid and I'm mad. So some stuff happened real early that was I think it targeted my life in a lot of ways. I could read really good. I could read really good. I could read to myself really good, and I could read out loud really good. I knew what words meant, but I didn't know how I knew what they meant. I knew what they meant out of context. I just knew what words meant. So they thought I was real smart. Here's what happened. They were disabused of that idea pretty quick now. Here's what happened. In the fourth grade, they introduced a thing called long division. I couldn't anymore do long division than I could fly. And they wanted to know why I wouldn't do it. They didn't believe I couldn't do it. There was no doubt about it. I tried to do it. I couldn't do it. And I remember to this day, they took me to the principal's office, and it was not an adversarial conversation. These were dedicated, elegant old women that had given their life to that little grant school. My teacher was an old lady named, this elderly lady named Mrs. Perkins, and she's a lifelong educator. The principal was a woman named Mrs. Cartwright. She was an old lady, lifelong educator. And there was another woman in that meeting, probably some kind of a counselor, or I don't know what she was. But what they wanted to know in that meeting is why I wouldn't do that long division. They didn't believe I couldn't do it. One of them, and you know how people will try to encourage you to get you going? I think it was the principal that said, it's a long time ago. I'm in fourth grade, and I'm going to be 71 here pretty quick. So it's a long time ago. But she said, "Why won't you do this? We know how smart you are. You're smarter than I am." Well, she probably, I mean, that wasn't true, but she's probably just trying to get me going. Well, I wondered why I wouldn't do it too. I mean, I wondered why I couldn't do it. And it was just like it was some kind of basic learning disability. Now, I've gotten arrogant over the years about it. I began to wonder over the years why anybody would want to do long division. It didn't make any sense to me. I took care of a large budget in the prison system for years. I spent most of my adult life in prison administration. And I'll assure you, I took care of a budget, but I didn't use any long division to do it. But that was a set tone. I mean, there was there's a lot of stuff I couldn't do. You know, I can't, I mean, there's just all kinds of stuff that just doesn't make any sense to me. It's like if I learn how to do something on a car, I have to memorize it. I don't understand it. And like to read a map, oh my gosh, that's worse than trying to understand Japanese. There's no way I'm going to read a map. That's why I hate to hear people say you can't miss it. Oh my God, when I learned how to use the telephone for directions, it revolutionized my life. I'd get in this big pavilion out in Cary. It's a Raleigh suburb. My granddaughter's softball games. I'd get out there. I wouldn't know which way to leave the lot. You know, there's about 15 exits. I'm driving around in there like I'm drunk. I mean, I'm clueless. I had a friend. He died a few years ago. But him and I, we drove thousands of miles to AA meetings together. Probably 20% of it lost. And when we lived in Omaha, we went down to Fort Riley, Kansas one time to hear this friend of ours was coming from California to speak. So we went down to Fort Riley, Kansas to hear him speak, and it was a big AA thing. So we pulled up to the gate. There was a young military police officer, a young woman, MP on the gate, and a nice young lady. We told her what we were looking for, so she looked it up on her chart. She brought this big thing out, and you know how on TV they'll get a poker to point to stuff like a doctor? She gets his poker and starts pointing, and both of us sat. She talked to us for about 5-10 minutes. Both of us sat there bobbing our head like this. We had no idea. We didn't know which way to pull the car off when she got done talking. And about that time, a car went by that had an Easy Does It sticker on it. I said, follow it. You know, so we drove right to the meeting. But I mean, it's just like a basic learning disability. So it was a lifelong problem. It took me forever to get it straightened out. Now, I don't want to brag about this, but I just want to tell you, I'm a former ping pong champion of the VA psych ward, Lincoln, Nebraska. And in that laughing academy, as Bill Wilson called them, there was a young head doctor, and I already had most of it figured out by this time because I'm a grown man by now. I'd spent 4 years. I'd gotten through school, and my life had tanked, and I'd spent four years in the military, came out. Anyway, he explained that what it was like part of his PhD was in right brain, left brain. He said it's all very, very baffling, but whatever's wrong is very small. And it's just one part of your brain that he said you might have been born that way. You might have been dropped when you were a kid. Really doesn't make any difference. But he said, as long as you stay away from anything having to do with anything mechanical, and now I would add technologically, he said, you're as smart as anybody else. Well, I already had a lot of it figured out by then. Nature has ways I sponsored a guy for a short period of time that was, he didn't stay in AA, but he was an expert in learning disabilities. He had a graduate education. And, I asked him one time, I said, well, what would they do with me if I were a little kid coming along today? Cause they'd probably catch it in grade school. He said, yeah, hopefully they would catch it today and do a little bit more with it. But I said, what would they do? He said, well, they'd do the same thing for you that you've learned through nature. You've learned ways to figure that stuff out. You've learned ways to compensate with that. That's what they would try to teach you, some ways. And so, but anyway, I went off in the military. You know, a teenager, my drinking now, I can track my active alcoholism from age 15 to 25, almost 26. I'll tell you about an early drinking experience. I had drank some before this. And I had a little bit of experience with girls before this, but here, you know, when it says in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that most of us have to be pretty badly mangled before we quit drinking. Well, the reason for that is you don't have to be a brain scientist to figure that out. That's because alcohol does so much for us. It's not like we're sick and then it's not like we're well and we get drunk and then get sick. It's like we're sick, we get drunk, we get well for a while. You know, alcohol's the greatest thing that, in a very real sense, I don't want to be cavalier about this, but alcohol and a spiritual awakening have done exactly the same thing for me. Made it so I can live in the world. That's exactly what they've done. Now, The problem with alcohol is I lingered way too long at the well, and stuff started to go south pretty early, and it took me forever to get caught on to that. But here's the story I wanted to tell you. I got a job as an elevator operator at a place called the Pathfinder Hotel. You remember those old elevators with the crank? You drive the elevator, and if you shoot it too high up, it'll stick, and if you drive it too low on the bottom, it'll stick. Well, I was a bellboy at this place, and I could drink as much there as I could steal. Well, I got my first older woman on that job. Now, she claimed to be 18. I was 15. I don't know how old she was, but it had been a couple days since she'd seen 18. She said she'd come in from the farm to look for a job. So here you have a 15-year-old child, scared of his shadow, can't get through his own name in an introduction. You fill him full of Budweiser beer or whatever that was we were drinking. It was good, cold, stolen beer from the Pathfinder Hotel. You fill him full of that, and the next thing you know, he's in bed with a full-grown woman. I'm here to tell you, you don't give up something like that very easy. I mean, if it takes you from lockjaw to in bed with a grown woman, I mean, come on. I mean, there's no secret about why I went back to the well time and time and time again. At that time in Nebraska, they were selling 3 quarts of beer for $1. Falstaff and Old Milwaukee. Pretty nasty stuff. But it ain't exactly like you're drinking for taste. It's kind of like the bar. You're sitting in the bar, you know, about midnight in there, perhaps talking to your best friend you met a few hours ago. He's probably another doctor or airline pilot. You know, the bar's not exactly about honesty. So anyway, we would buy those cases of quartz, buy $4 for a case of quartz. And, oh my gosh, it was just amazing. Now, my drinking caused trouble right from the very beginning. I'd get arrested for things like minor in possession or trespassing, or I'd pop off and get hit in the mouth or something like that. But the consequences were well worth it. And I don't mind telling you, if they never got any worse than I was when I was 16, 17-year-old kid, there'd have been no reason to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was well worth it. What happened is I was in trouble with the law, and you got to remember, it was a different time. This is moving towards the late 1960s. A very dishonest recruiter told me to come up with as much money as I could get a hold of, and he would give it to one of the detectives at the police station, who was a retired Navy recruiter. They would throw my records away, and I would go off into the military. Now, I know that guy was lying, and now what he did with that money is put it in his pocket. I'll even tell you how much it was. I came up with $60, and I'm pretty sure the Air Force got cheated. But anyway, I went off to the military, and I cheated on the test to get in. So what happened is the military decided to turn me into an aircraft mechanic. Now, I've just told you, I can't fix anything. At this time, they had just come out with those disposable razors. And I was so glad about that, because I'd actually thrown a couple razors away because I couldn't figure out how to get the blade in them. So anyway, I go off into the military. I make it through basic training, and they send me to Wichita Falls, Texas to learn how to work on airplanes. Now, you can imagine what a mess that was. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. You really have to wonder about the brains of the military at this point. They get us all together. I'm in Wichita Falls, Texas. I'd never even heard of Wichita Falls, Texas before I got there. And they said, it's your basic rah-rah talk for young recruits. They said, you've completed basic training. You're one step closer to the regular Air Force. You're here for school, but you're one step closer to the regular Air Force. And you can go anywhere in Wichita Falls, Texas this weekend on base pass, town pass, except Flood Street. You can't go on Flood Street. It's off limits by order of the base commander. Well, you know what I did? I got drunk and went down on Flood Street to find out why they don't want you down there. You know, it says in our literature several places about our defiance. I believe what it says in AA literature, but I don't think you have to read that to know we're defiant. You know, we'll take a beat. The guy sponsor, he's a great AA member. He works with a lot of people. I've been sponsoring him since the 90s. He's sober, I don't know, 31 or 32 years, great member. A while back, he was getting some trucks or some tires put on his godson's truck. And I said, he got plenty of money, but it was costing him some money, and he put them on him. And so he gets in an argument with the guy. They were giving him a really good deal. And so he got in an argument with the guy. He said, drop the truck. Take the tires off. I ain't buying them. And he's going to save a couple hundred dollars on this deal. He said, the guy said, I don't care. I don't care. Get the truck down. So when he got home, his wife hit him. What's that old deal about cut your nose off to spite your face? She hit him with that, and he said, that's right. I did. My nose and my face. You know, so I mean, we're just going to prove a point what we're going to do. You know the old deal. Would you rather be right or happy? Well, I'd rather be both, tell you the truth. And then right or happy, it just depends on what the situation is. If I got a little bit of time to shoot up some prayers and maybe, you know, talk to my sponsor or another AA member or read something, I'd probably want to be happy. If it just happens that I don't get the pause in, I'd probably want to be right. So, you know, I've grown up some, but got a long ways to go. But anyway, I got kicked out of that school and I got sent to Arkansas. It was a different time. I got arrested 3 times in the state of Arkansas. And they actually let me decide. They actually called me in and said, we are willing to process you on a 3912 discharge. And I didn't want that. It simply means it's called a general discharge, but it really means you're a misfit. You can't conform. You can't conform to military standards. Or you can take your shipment to Vietnam. It's your call. But the Major Foy said, you're leaving here one way or another. He said, you can't stay on his airplane patch any longer. You're leaving here. And I said, well, I'll take my shipment. So in January of 1970, off I went to Vietnam. Now, my drinking is already, I mean, the military did nothing to make me an alcoholic. If anything, they might have created an environment where they sped it up a little bit. I don't know. But, I mean, I was a full-blown alcoholic before I went in there. But by the time I get to Vietnam, I'm in bad shape now. I get sick if I don't drink in the morning. I went on sick call one. I used to get these horrible cramps. And I didn't get them all the time, but I used to get these horrible, horrible cramps. I don't know what I thought, but it was just horrible. I could barely walk. Well, I went on sick call one day and with that. And there was a young doctor, a captain on CQ. And he asked me, strangest thing, he asked me some questions about my drinking. And one of the questions he asked me, he said, do you drink in the morning after you wake up? I said, I do. So he asked me a few other questions and he got all done. You know what he diagnosed me with? Food poisoning. Now, he knew what it was and I knew. He knew I knew and I knew that he knew what was going on. But what he did is he just kept me out of trouble. He said, I ain't giving you an excuse to get off work, though. I ain't going to give you that, but I'll diagnose you with food poisoning. But it wasn't food poisoning. But by now, my alcoholism is in bad shape. All right, here's what happens. I come back to the United States after 1 year. I get stationed in a place called Spokane, Washington. My drinking's in really, really bad shape now. You know how we talk about the progressive nature of alcoholism, how alcoholism gets worse over a period of time? We all know that's true, right? We've experienced it. We don't need to be learned in it. We've lived it. But you know how you'll see somebody at a meeting that you saw last year, and last year they still had their wife and kids, or she still had her big job, or whatever it was. They were holding it together, and now they left AA, and now they're back, and whatever it is that had drove them here before was gone. I think of a university of professor that when he came back, friend of mine, one of my best friends was sponsoring this guy. And when the guy came back, my man told me, he said, hell, he said, in private conversation, he hardly makes sense. You know, they got him out. He was a tenured professor at the university and they got him out of there. He thinks he's going to sue the dean and the university. He said, hell, you can't hardly understand him when he talks. He's in such bad shape. But that's the progression of the illness. But besides the actual devastation of the actual drinking, there's a lot of other stuff going on with progression. There's fear, there's anger, there's rage, there's isolation, there's blaming other people. The loneliness of alcoholism, that you remember that commercial, it's a lonely illness. I don't know if the loneliness of alcoholism is worse than other kinds of loneliness, but it's different because it doesn't have anything to do with the proximity of people. Speaking about my old sponsor, Keith Lewis, used to talk about laying in bed. He's at the big meeting now, but I hope he's watching. He used to talk about laying in bed next to a woman he loved and he thought loved him. And they'd lay in bed with their legs touching, stiff as a board, because he'd been drunk one more time and ruined everything, not knowing what to say. And communication's tough. Remember Bill Wilson wrote that thing called The Inner Course of the Heart. the communication of the heart. What comes from the heart reaches the heart. You know, sometimes we say that when an alcoholic is disabused, when they come to Alcoholics Anonymous, what we hope to do is ruin their drinking anyway. You know, that what's the old saying? Nothing worse than a head full of AA and a belly full of whiskey. You know, not, it doesn't impact everybody. It never bothered my dad anymore. I mean, he hated AA from the time, thinking about him because of Father's Day. He hated AA from the, his experience was exactly different than mine. I loved AA from the beginning. I wasn't sure it was going to work for me. In fact, there was times I was pretty sure it wasn't going to work. But he hated AA with a passion. In fact, as he told my aunt, if anything would make a man drink, AA would do it. You know, so, I mean, he just hated AA. But my experience was completely different. So anyway, the progressive nature of this, so I get up to the state of Washington. I'm not going to take a fifth step. It'd be inappropriate. But I'm involved with some people that are outside the long arm of the law. My alcoholism's in bad shape. I'm a good bit. What happens in early 1971, I guess, because of alcoholism, because of hatred, and just because of the way I'm living, I'm a good bit responsible for the death of another person. Now, it wouldn't be fair then or now to say that that didn't bother me, but it certainly didn't bother me then like it was going to come to later. One of the things the spiritual life makes clear is the more something is pushed down, the more it's denied or the more ugly it is when it's disregarded and tried to run away from it, the more vile or violent it is when it comes back up. You know, you can't outrun your past. That's why in Alcoholics Anonymous, we do the steps. We've got steps that directly, you could say in a global way, all of our steps impact the past. But you know, we've got two steps that directly move with that. Steps 8 and 9, and then we have a 10th step to admit when we're wrong. That's more usually associated with right now. But, you know, if you can get to the bottom of the 9th step and get the amends cleared away, we've got a jet engine for life because you've wiped out the past. You know, I heard a guy say one time, this sounds a little lofty when you think about it, but it's intensely practical. It sounds like one of those things that's like, ooh, you know, it's just otherworldly, but he said, there ain't no past and there ain't no future. All there is eternity and you're pulling it right now. It's always right now. And that's where I'm safe. My problems have always been associated with the past or the future. So the way that works in real time, if you've wiped out the past, that means everything's new. So if I have a fight with my wife, that's a virgin fight. I'm not laying it on top of the last 20 years or 30 years or whatever it might be. It's always new. There is no past. So I'm always operating within the power of right now. You know how you hear alcoholics say in closed meetings all the time, I'm at my best when I'm working with another alcoholic? Well, I've always thought the reason for that is because we forget we're there. We're just trying to impart something. We're trying to give something. So I'm not worried about how I look or how I sound or anything. So I'm not living in the past. My problems have always been with the past. I'm either angry or resentful about the past, or I'm afraid of what's going to happen or not going to happen in the future. But if I'm living right now, even if things aren't the way I want, I'm fine. Seems to be the way God equipped us to live in the power right now. But anyway, there was a very kind doctor. I got to get up. I got to push on with this. I think I messed around too long at the beginning. I got to push on with this or we'll be here. If I get stuck in Bill's bar, we'll be here forever. Anyway, there was a very kind doctor who kept me from getting kicked out of the military. I should have been put out of the military. I was in more trouble than people were who were getting kicked out. This guy loved me. He offered to buy, I don't know, this guy just loved me. He was an ENT surgeon. And he said, if you'll straighten up, he was going to get out of the military about the same time I was. He said, I'll buy a couple gas stations in the St. Louis area and you can manage them. He literally kept me from getting kicked out of the military. He diagnosed me one time and put me in a tent up on a floor all by myself. People were afraid to come up there. They thought I was toxic. There wasn't anything wrong with me. I'm just drunk. But he kept me from getting kicked out of the military. Anybody that's been in the military knows there's two people that are packing real power. One's a medical doctor and the other one's a chaplain. So he kept me from getting kicked out of the military. But anyway, I get out of the military in the summer of 1972. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay May 26, 1975. So I'm going to rush on with this real fast. You'll just have to put the pieces together. This is a little choppy, even for me. I work with a lot of new people, so I'm well aware of the fact that, newcomers, people can get very drunk in North Carolina, right? I'm aware of that. But I suspect we've got 15 or 20 bars in Nebraska to every bar in North Carolina. My sister lives in a town of 263 people. I think they've had three bars in that town for years. One of them might have finally closed, but they've had three bars in a town of 263 people. And there's bars everywhere in Nebraska. I sobered up at a place called Chapter 5. There was a bar on each side. You could sit in there at night and listen to the country music come through the walls. Now, I wasn't allowed to go in either one of them bars anyway, so it didn't make much difference. But right down the street, on the other side of the street, was a place called Bill's Bar. Have you ever been in one of those bars where everybody in there needed to be an AA? You ever seen a bar like that? Even the people that worked in there were drunk. Bill had made his fortune in the garbage and septic tank business and bought that bar as a toy for his drunken wife, Phyllis. We had a guy in that bar named Vibrator Hartman. Vibrator got drunk one New Year's Eve and burned up in a fire. We had a guy named Rodney Montaney. Rodney got in a fight with a guy in a wheelchair and tipped him over. The way Rodney described it, he said, "He hit me a good one, but I tipped him over before they got me out of there." We had a guy named Leonard Larson. Leonard had no neck. His head sat right on his shoulders. And what Leonard would do is he'd crawl around on his hands and knees and lift bar stools over his head to perform feats of strength. But the two most colorful characters came into that bar about the same time I showed up. I showed up in the summer of 1972, just out of 4 years in the military. And these two brothers showed up named Billy and Tommy Walker. Now, you know how when somebody tells, even when you're drinking, you ever had the experience of somebody telling you something that's plausible, but you somehow know it's not true, right? When I first met Billy Walker, he told me he was just out of the 101st Airborne. Now, I knew that day Billy Walker was not coming from the 101st Airborne. He was coming from a penitentiary somewhere. Absolutely, no doubt. Now, when I started drinking with the Walker boys, I'm a beer drinker, but I'll drink anything. And at that time, I could literally drink beer for 24, 30 hours, whatever it was. I'd be drunk, but I could talk to people. I could drive a car, but you let me take one drink of whiskey, one drink of Mad Dog wine, I just never remember. So Billy Walker drank dry gin and chased it with squirt. Tommy Walker drank bar whiskey and chased it with water. So when I started drinking with him, I started drinking that gin. This is the kind of brains you had in Bill's Bar at that time. This is what Billy Walker told me. He said, the way we're drinking this gin, he said, there's a couple things you got to remember. Drink the gin in a shot glass. Never breathe when you're drinking it because it's nasty and it can make you gag. And if you ever drank any dry gin, particularly when it's hot, you know he's telling the truth. It'll just make you shiver. You got to be about half drunk to drink it. So he said, what you do is you drink it down real fast, don't breathe, and then chase it with squirt. I said, that's fine, Billy. That's good with me. He said, the other thing you got to start to do is use a lot of pepper on your food. Now, we ain't eating much in those days anyway. And I said, what will that do? And he said, well, the way we're drinking this gin, it'll hurt your liver. But if you put a lot of pepper on your food, it'll counteract the damage. Now, I mean, I don't know where that came from, but that's what he said. There was a couple reasons I like to drink with those guys. One reason is, now, I went up a pant size a year. Went for maybe 2, 3 years, 4 years, I don't know when I got sober. But Billy Walker never was any bigger than I am right now. But he would attack people. He looked like that dog on the Greyhound bus. He'd attack people and knock them out, be the end of them. And I also had it in my head that Billy Walker could get a lot of women. So my idea was I'm going to hang around with him and see how things go. Here's what happened. Fast forward, Thanksgiving season, 1974. I'm just back from California one more time. I'd gotten a job, very short time, got fired from that job. I'm in Bill's Bar. There was a lady and her boyfriend invited another guy and I to their house for Thanksgiving dinner in 1974. Now, the guy that I went to, they invited a guy named Butch and I to their house. I'd been in a terrible tractor-trailer accident with Butch. I was in the sleeper when the trailer came through there, right above where my head was. It gashed a big hole and you could look out and see the sky. And it ruptured the fuel tank on the driver's side. Highway patrol had been out there, the fire engines hosing off the diesel fuel. Butch said he watched a trailer come around in the mirror and hit, said, didn't even spill the beer between his legs. I slept through the whole thing. Nobody knew I was there. I didn't know I was there. I didn't know it. I passed out, slept through the whole thing. But anyway, they invited us to their house for Thanksgiving dinner. and I never left. Libby had a great big beautiful, Libby and her boyfriend were both permanent party at Bill's Bar. Libby had a big, beautiful Thanksgiving dinner. She had her children in. I couldn't eat. I'm sick. I wake up now. Every time I wake up, I'm sick again. It's taken me like 2 or 3 hours to get enough of alcohol to stay down, to get well. I get sick again. I'm in bad shape. Libby had a talk with me that went very much like this. In fact, it's almost exactly like this. She said, I've been around alcoholics all my life. I've been married to two alcoholics, but I've never seen anything like you at your age. There's a man in town who helped my last ex-husband. My ex-husband's got a full-time job. He's had it for 1 year. He's been sober for over a year now. He's paying his child support. He's doing really well. If you want me to call that guy, I'll call him. Now, if I were to say I was looking for a way out already, you'd understand what I meant, right? I'd been looking for some way out. I had some plans. One plan was I was going to marry a rich woman. I might have been a little slow on the take-up, but I'm figuring this ain't looking good for the home team. That probably ain't going to happen. My other plan was I'm going to get a job. But it's always tomorrow. I'm going to get a job tomorrow. What I'm going to do tomorrow when I wake up, I'm going to sip a little bit of beer to take the edge off, and then I'm going to go get a job. That I'm not going to drink any booze. I'm just going to sip beer. But that made sense day after day. It's kind of like saying I'm not going to drive a car when I'm drinking. That makes perfect sense till I start drinking. Then it doesn't make sense anymore. And my other plan, which I would submit, was a lot more likely I was going to kill myself. So Libby called him. And November 30th, 1974, you could say that that's a target, a red letter day, banner day. My life has never been the same. A guy named Bob Brannigan rolled up. Spent all Saturday afternoon with me, and I don't remember much of it, but I went on many of those calls with him later. I sobered up right at the end of real active 12-step call where people would come in and we would go out to their house. That was to end in the numbers that it did. It still goes on, but it's much less than, even in a little town of 25,000 people, there was times I went on two of those a day when I got sober. What he did is he told me the story of his life, what he used to be like, what had happened, and what he was like now. And some of what he told me didn't make any sense. He said he'd had a wife and five kids, and he'd built him a new home. He said he lost the house and his family, and he said he should have lost it. I didn't make much sense to me. I didn't understand that. I asked him a question I guess anybody that doesn't understand alcoholism would ask. I said, how do you get the willpower? I've been around alcohol. I grew up in alcoholism. I was a horrible alcoholic myself. I guess anybody would ask the question, how do you get the willpower to not drink? He said, I look on that a little bit different than you do. He said, the way I look on it is that what willpower is the way you take that drink and it's going to come back up. That's what I think willpower is. And I remember asking him, how long since you drank? And he said, if I can make it till September, it'll be 11 years. And I guess now it's what, 56 years? I just talked to him a while back. He can't drive anymore. He's got diabetes real bad. He can't see. Enough to drive, so his wife, and not his wife, he's lost his wife, but his kids and grandkids take him to meetings. I guess he's still sober because he's still doing the things he did with me. But the next day, December 1st, 1974, he carted me off to the state hospital. And something memorable about that trip. I needed a drink bad, but he wouldn't get me one. There was another guy with us, 25 years old, is now dead from drinking. But he bought me a carton of Marlboro cigarettes and a can of 7-Up. And you know what I told him? You know the line. I'll pay you back. And you know what he said? He said, that ain't the way this works. He said, you'll be expected to help someone else when you're able. I want to say something about Libby and her boyfriend. Now, they were permanent party in Bill's Bar, right? This is a rough crowd. Libby's boyfriend, a guy named Sal, good guy, bad drunk. Sal told me one time, he said, the way things were going for a while, he thought he could have possibly been an alcoholic, but he found out he wasn't. Well, if he hadn't won, there's never been one. But he was a bull hauler. You know, they butcher more hogs and cows in Nebraska than most places. And Sal was a bull hauler on that 48 states in Canada. Libby was a rough customer. She'd stick a fist in your mouth or have one of her boyfriends do it. She changed men about people like change clothes, but her heart was as big as Nebraska. Sal wanted to marry her, so he drug her across the river into Iowa to meet his mom. I knew she wasn't going to marry him. So Libby told me when Sal went to the bathroom, his mom called her into the kitchen and said, honey, let me give you some advice. If you know what's good for you, you'll get as far away from that drunken bum as quick as you can because he's going to ruin your life. Now, that's his mom talking. So this is a rough crowd, right? But this is what I'd like to say about them, particularly around the founding of AA. AA would be a very different place Many of us were got in here by people who couldn't get in here themselves. Many of us were gotten in here by non-alcoholics. Even a casual observation of AA history makes it critically clear. We'd have never got AA going without the non-alcoholic. We are still served today by non-alcoholics. I'm one who would most likely be dead had it not been for my great aunt who was a non-alcoholic. I mean, you could argue God would have worked it out another way, but the way it worked out, I mean, she was, you know, she took me in, I'm homeless. So anyway, I wake up on May 26th. From the time I was introduced to it till I got sober was a period of about 6 months. I wake up on Memorial Day, Monday. It's always on a Monday, and the date changes, but it was May 26th that year. I woke up at 2 a.m. I had two bottles of wine, but I had them hidden, and I hid them from myself. You ever done that? Now, that is a revolting development, to know you've got booze, but you can't find it. The guy that drank them is now dead. Now, I don't think those two bottles of wine killed him. I'm pretty sure they didn't help him. I didn't know what had happened. I asked the guy I'd been drinking with that's now dead, too. I said, you know, Roger, what happened? He said, well, we were riding around with Richard. And he said, you know, Richard's nerves are bad. That could not be argued. Richard's nerves were bad. Somebody would get about two or three words out of their mouth, Richard would nail them. And I always did pretty good with him. He always liked me. And he said, but we were riding around drinking beer with Richard. Richard told you three or four times to shut up. You wouldn't shut up, so he hit you. I said, Richard hit me? He said, yeah, right in the mouth, hard too. I said, what did I do? He said, you started crying. So anyway, that was the beginning. So a week or two after that, I've never been sure how long, my great aunt invited me to come and live with her. And I did. I went and I moved into an old established neighborhood. My great aunt was 75 years old. So I'm 25, almost 26. I was the youngest person in that neighborhood by 50 years, I suppose. And I began to go to AA meetings on a daily basis. And I fell under the care of people who absolutely understood Alcoholics Anonymous. I never heard any of that stuff. You know, it's gotten trendy for people to talk about what AA used to be like. And they say things like, it was a different place when I come here. They told me to shut up and get in the car and put the cotton in your mouth. You got two ears and one mouth. I never got any of that. What I got was, follow me. I'll cut you a path. This is more powerful than alcoholism. We got this. All you got to do is not drink today, read AA literature, come to the meetings, stick with us. We got you. And it's proven to be true. There was a guy living right down the street from my great aunt. He was sober two or three weeks longer than me. I'm still in touch with him. He looked like a prisoner of war. He was almost 6 feet tall. He weighed 116 pounds when he came to AA. I don't know what I must have looked like, but he told me, he said, when I saw you the first time, I told my wife, there's one that's really hurting. I mean, I don't know what I must have looked like. But here's what happened. We began to go to AA meetings on a daily basis and started to put these steps in place in our life. Like I said, I didn't work much the first year, and then when I was sober about a year and a half, it was a different time. I went to work in the court system. I went as far as you could go in the working in the field in the Department of Correction. Could have went to the head shed if the politics would have been different. But now, if I were to come along now, there's no way I would have got into probation or any of those things. But it's the way it was then. A guy hired me. I had no education, fat, dumb, and happy. On Sunday and Monday, I become an officer of the court. And that was in January of 1977. I stayed in that work over 30 years. So I don't have time to go into it now, Billy. We'll do it another time. But my life has changed. I mean, I've grown up here. I've had every problem everybody else has had. I was married to the same girl for 17 years. I got divorced here. I've had sickness. I had illness. I had all kinds of stuff. I've come close to losing my mind a couple of times. But I'll tell you, there's three mistakes I haven't made since I got sober. I know people are pretty serious in this part of the country about stopping meetings on an hour. So I'm headed in that direction, Billy. I'm getting rattled now. You know, we got a whole part of the country now that has hour and a half meetings and all that, but I'm headed towards the finish line, so stay with me. It's not like we never drank after 9 o'clock on a Sunday night now. But there's three mistakes I've never made since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Number one, never drank any alcohol while I'm still sober. Remember what they told me when I was new. Don't take a drink. You can't get drunk. You know how you feel like you're going to be struck drunk? You know, you think that's going to... No. My man told me this. That ain't going to happen. That's not going to happen. You're not going to be struck drunk. Don't take a drink. You won't get drunk. 45 plus years, never took a drink. Second mistake I've never made. I've never quit going to meetings. Integral to what we do. Fundamental to what we do. Meetings won't keep you sober. They're just one thing we do. We all know AA is a way of life. You can go to meetings and pound air and die drunk. But they're very important to what we do. That's why a home group is so important. My old sponsor, who's still living but in Alzheimer's, used to say about people who didn't have a home group, he'd say, well, that's fine. But he said, everybody's members, nobody's member, to tell you the truth. You need a home group. And the third mistake I've never made, I don't think we talk about this much, but I'm going to head for the home stretch on this. I've never trusted the wrong person. AA is a very unique place. You get to pick your leaders here. It's a very unusual place. I had some management training one time that said if you work for a man or woman that you wouldn't hire if the shoe was on the other foot, you're going to have trouble every time. You can do it. Most of us aren't in a position to decide who our boss is. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, you get to pick your leaders. You get to pick your sponsor. A dear friend of mine was elected. He's a trustee recently. I was with him the week before the pandemic. We were together out in Oklahoma. He doesn't think it's a big deal, but I think it's a big deal. The first thing I do when somebody becomes a leader in Alcoholics Anonymous, like a delegate or a steering chair of the steering committee in my group or whatever, or a trustee, I always look. I don't think this is a good thing. It just happens automatically. I think, is that somebody I would have drank with if I'd have had my own money? Now, I always put in there if I had my own money because I'm going to drink with Lucifer. I ain't got any money now. I mean, but would I have drank with that person if I had my own money? That's the first thing I ask. And the other thing is that somebody I can get behind? And so I think it's very important. We get to pick our sponsors in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can tell you, I've dealt with some heavy-duty stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. To the best of my knowledge, I have never had a confidence violated. Now, what I have had is a sponsor who took it to their sponsor. That's fine with me. I understand how that stuff works. That's fine with me. I know Keith did. I know he talked to Tom about stuff when Tom was my boss and Keith was my sponsor. And then later, Keith got sick, and then Tom had left the prison system, became my sponsor. In a way, it was very helpful because I was close to Tom when he was my boss, but he didn't have to get up to speed on my case. He knew what it was. So it's a great thing that we get to do that. And so what we are in Alcoholics Anonymous, we're a mutual aid society. We don't have anything to do with the good help and the bad. We're in this together. You know, the closing thing I'll say is our first tradition says most of us can't recover without the group. So we need each other. And once I got figured out, there's no place else for me to go, AA is a very easy place to stay. If somebody's going to leave today, it ain't going to be me because there ain't nowhere else to go. Once you get that figured out, pretty much, I mean, alcoholism doesn't go away, but you've hit a stride. So, Billy, I appreciate the invitation. Lynn, always good to see you. I think you lift Billy up, probably the rest of us too. So, thank you. God bless you.